This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 98-year-old John Parker of Merced, California. Drafted into the Army in 1943, he originally trained with a tank destroyer battalion until the need for infantrymen took precedence. In 1944, with his wife Irene back home in California, he headed across the Atlantic on the Queen Elizabeth, waiting to find out the unit to which he would be assigned.
Joined the 84th Infantry Division, 333rd Regiment at Guilenkirk. And we were in it's a small village, and within a few days then we had moved on and were living in German bunkers that they had built in the Siegfried Line. And then we were there until we kept moving on, of course, and whatever the 84th Infantry Division had to do. We were living in whatever conditions we ran across. They would have, command air houses and everything. But also when we went over on the Elizabeth, we were discharged at the Firth of Clyde, which is northern Scotland. And then we went through the process of moving down through England, across the Channel into France. And that was kind of interesting. You'd be there for a couple of days and then your name would be called and then you could move on.
Was there a welcome to the war moment for you? Was there a moment where you realized how dangerous a situation this was going to be?
Well, I'd when the last move that we went in Belgium, an artillery institution in Belgium, and we could hear fire and watch the planes, and we knew we were getting close to combat, and that's always in your mind. But one thing, when we did join the 84th Infantry Division, we joined a platoon. We were in 3rd Battalion, and it was almost comforting to join because this was family. You're going to be with these people here. And they were all glad to see you,
Because before that, you don't know where you're going to end up. Now you finally belong somewhere, huh?
Now you belong. And that was a good feeling. It was a good feeling. That came probably from my background, because when we lived in Phoenix and my grandfather came there, and he had 5 daughters and my father, 1 boy, it was a big family then. And everybody got together at holidays. It was a big family, and we missed that a little bit when then we moved to California. But family was a big thing in our family, in our life.
So when you're there, so far away from your real family, these other guys in uniform who you've never spent any time with before, they turned into your family in a hurry?
Yeah, they did. It was family. You're back to family again. I think that's why it was good, and it felt good. Here we're going into combat, and I'm enjoying combat unit, and yet it felt good because it was just family again.
And I'm sure that every day was different and unique and had its own fair share of challenges. But can you give us an example of what the day-to-day existence in combat was like for a guy in a rifle platoon in the 84th Infantry Division?
Well, it varied. When we joined, it was getting into winter. They'd experienced, I think, that winter was the coldest they'd had in 25 years, I think. And so living out was terrible. And snow, and it was not good. The experience of combat, if people want to know, they can go to a movie and see what happens in combat. And it was tough.
Was there anything that you had done in training or anything in your life that prepared you for that feeling of the enemy shooting at you?
Well, you imagined a lot of what combat would be, but you always worried a lot about it, and of course you read about it, and you were trained even for hand-to-hand combat. We went through training in the infantry, and that's one thing that I never experienced was hand-to-hand combat. Fortunately, when we were sent down to work on the Bulge, the Germans were advancing, of course, as far as they could go. Then we moved there in the northern sector, and then it was the reverse. They had to retreat because the Allies were overpowered with not only men, but also machinery that was needed.
Well, a lot of questions come to mind because I know you faced a lot of hazards. But maybe let's start with the weather, because you mentioned how cold it was, and it's documented that was the worst winter they'd had in decades. And here you are, a guy from Arizona and California, out in feet and feet of snow. What did you have to keep you warm? How did you stay warm? How'd you survive that?
Well, we were supposed to get winter gear, and I'm not sure what that was, but it was always late coming. It was like the army, you know, there. But it was cold, and you had to live. We were outside most of the time, and I remember one night we had to move from point A to point B and spent probably 5 or 6 hours, and the whole company was out in the snow. And when you're doing that, you're not in a hurry because they have to move a little bit, and then you stand and you wait, and you're out in the snow. And the cold was terrible, really was awful. Yeah, and I had never experienced that kind of, living in southern Arizona all my life. I had nothing, no experience with snow.
Well, I'm just thinking about that and wondering how you avoided getting frostbite or having your toes turn black or losing some of your extremities. Were there some things you did to combat that?
Well, you try to keep them dry, of course, and then you need to even take your shoes and socks off if you're on a rest and you're not in combat at that time, and rub your feet, keep the circulation going, and it helps.
And when you say the Battle of the Bulge, I mean, most people think this big, monstrous battle where thousands and thousands died, and it was tragic. But I'm sure you're just seeing a little sliver of it. Was it not until afterwards that you realized how massive an operation that was and how many guys had lost their lives, or did you see signs of that as it was unfolding?
Well, you could see part of that because we were in one sector. We were on the northern sector of the Battle of the Bulge. All the publicity and notoriety really was from where Bastogne was and Patton trying to reach there, and they were trying to live in siege by the Germans. But it wasn't good.
And I've got to ask you, I know some of these things are harder to talk about than others, but you mentioned that feeling of family once you knew your outfit, you knew this platoon you're going to be with. I have to imagine that you probably had to deal with losing some of those guys who had become your family. What was that like, and how did you handle it?
Well, that's just part of life over there. You expect that. And when I joined the platoon in Geilenkirchen, the day before they had a firefight, and the fellow that I replaced, I never didn't get to know his name. But, you know, you just learn to live with the idea that you might be wounded. I remember soon after I joined the platoon, we were moving from one place to another and moving through a forest. And Germans started sending artillery in, and we had tree bursts. And that was terrible. And we had soldiers yelling and people yelling for a medic all the time. And you could hear the tree bursts, and it was pretty bad. I'd become a Christian, and we were all a Christian family. But at that time, I said, Lord, we need help here. But I came close to, I think, just breaking, but the Lord helped me through that.
And when you talk about tree bursts, some people might not be familiar with what that means, but you're in the forest, and all those trees around you basically become additional shrapnel that these artillery shells can create and spray everywhere. So you say, and it's dark, but you hear your fellow soldiers crying out in pain, asking for medics. And what did you do? Did you keep moving? Did you hunker down? How did you avoid getting hit?
Well, you don't have time, and the ground's frozen anyway because you can't dig a foxhole. No. And all you can do is just lay down, and tree bursts are terrible because when the shells hit the trees and they burst, the shrapnel can go any place. Your targets, if they're not tree bursts and they burst on the ground, then the shrapnel, none of it goes down because it's already there. So most of it has to go up or to the side. And there's always a chance that you can survive that.
But there's really nowhere to hide. And you just talked about it, what that did to you, that it almost broke you, that it brought you to a point where God was your only relief or your only outlet, the only person you could appeal to in that moment. And I don't want to harp on it and press on it and make it more than it was, but it sounds like an overwhelming moment for you that kind of is still there, that you can remember what that felt like. Can you help us understand what that felt like?
Well, you were people dying around you, people being wounded around you, all the yelling and, for medic, and the medics were trying to reach everybody. And it was pretty bad. You realize that in an instant you could be gone or be wounded. But the Lord helped me through that.
And I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but is that a situation where you think about that wife back home who you were only married to for a little more than a month before the Army took you away?
Oh, yeah. You miss that. Yeah, miss being home with family, and it was hard.
A lot of guys have said, you know, they carried a photo of their wife around or, you know, something from her. Is there something you did to make it like her presence was always with you while you were over there?
Well, I had pictures of my wife and the family, too, and that always helped. And letters were great, too. Letters were wonderful. You're keeping in touch. Of course, now, wherever they are, they can call home. We couldn't call home.
I'm sure you would have loved to many times. And with the Bulge specifically, you talked about being on the northern part. Was that something where it felt like it was never going to end, or could you see the progress that was being made?
Well, we had reports. And, of course, like where you are, you really don't get a lot of news. It filters down to you, but some of it's good, some of it's bad. We were hearing also of the terrible things that were happening down in Bastogne. They had the massacre down there, and people talked about that. We were doing mostly moving a lot. And then when the Bulge failed as far as the Germans were concerned, then they were on the way back because they had to reverse and go the other direction.
When you say the massacre, do you mean the Malmedy massacre when they captured the Americans and just gunned them down?
Yeah, and shot them, killed all of them. And I think probably that changed a lot of the attitude of the soldiers, too. They were saying, no more prisoners, no more prisoners, you know. Now, how often that happened, I don't know.
You're hearing them say that, and the implication is they're not going to take any chances with German prisoners. They're going to treat them the same way the Germans treated the Americans.
Yeah, I'm sure that happened, but I don't know statistics whether they really have that down as record or not. I don't know, but I'm sure it went through a lot of minds that time.
And you told us about, you know, with those tree bursts in the forest, and you said that God helped you. When you say God helped me, is that just with your own psyche and your own mindset walking through all this, or do you look back at specific moments and say, boy, that's pretty amazing that I survived and there must have been something else going on there?
Well, yeah, I think you fear for your life. That can be in the environment that you are at the time, and all the tree bursts and all the noise and the yelling, and it was pretty bad. But you trust in the Lord, and it helped. I calmed down, and then we moved on after that.
Are there instances that you look back on and you say, that was a pretty close call? I almost that one almost had my name on it?
Oh, sure, yeah. And a lot of times, you know, your firefights, you think about that, you know. But it's a risk, and you just live with that.
Not trying to be salacious here or anything, but just to understand, what would you say is the closest that an enemy round or shell or some piece of artillery came to you?
Well, probably rifle fire that was close to me. We didn't really get a lot of artillery fire. That was one of the worst ones that I experienced. But we did have experiences, I remember, and this was back to snow again. We were going, the hill was in front of us. And that night, I was chosen to be on a patrol to go up and see at the top of there if there's any Germans up there. So we did, and crawled up. We could hear the Germans talking, and then we went back and reported. Then the next morning, we had one tank with us, and he started up, and then we were out flanked on both sides. And when we got there, the Germans were gone. But we didn't know that, of course. I think people would like to get behind the tank, you know.
Yeah, and it's hard to blame them. And when you say the rifle fire came close, are we talking a couple feet? Are we talking a couple inches? How close do you think it came to you?
Probably within feet, yeah, close enough. And you hear a lot. And when we ran across the tank destroyer unit there in Germany, he says, there's a German Tiger down there, and he's firing at him. I heard one shot, but they were terrible. You could hear those go by. It was pretty bad.
I have to imagine you heard the 88s a time or two, too, huh?
Yeah, heard 88s. And they're terrible sounds, you know. Yeah, it was bad.
You're not a very old guy at this point, by our understanding today. See, if you're born in 1919 and this is December of 44, you're 25 years old?
25 years old.
And you're probably an old man compared to the guys around you.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you're 25, there's probably some 18, 19, 20-year-olds around you.
Yeah. And when I moved in with the company and the platoon that I joined, yeah, I was older. I was the fellow and I went to school with in France. He was staff sergeant. I was buck sergeant. I had three stripes. He had four. I think that I had replaced somebody, I think, the day before, had been wounded or killed. And and I was a replacement for him.
That is the reality of a replacement soldier. You're needed because the guy who occupied that spot you're filling is no longer able to fight. Time for another break, but when we come back, I'm going to read for you the citation accompanying the Bronze Star awarded to John Parker in January 1945. Don't forget to check out the photos and a short video of John at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll have the rest of today's conversation right after this.